Hey, we are live for the MMA Perspective. We are back for the first time in a long time. Tom is out vigorously rubbing himself on foreign objects over Ohio State's big win the other day. And so he couldn't be with us for this episode. I'm joined by my other regular co-host, Patrick Wyman of SureDog.com. Pat, how you doing?
I am doing fantastic. Actually, I'm freezing my fucking balls off because it's about 55 degrees in Los Angeles. And while that is not actually cold, hear me out, no building here has proper insulation. So if it's 55 outside, it's 55 inside, unless your heat's working. And guess what? The heat in my apartment, not working. We got a giant fucking space heater going. I'm wearing three layers. I've got blankets everywhere. This
you know
sucks.
What? That is totally... That's a totally cool read, and I get that. That's okay. I understand. I keep my house at like 68. I wouldn't want it to be 55. That would fucking suck. It would be freezing. But you live in LA, so go fuck yourself.
That is a totally viable counterpoint. I will accept that. That is fine.
Yeah, it's gonna be 75 for the rest of your fucking year. I don't give a shit if it's 55 today. All right. Beyond that, we've got a lot of catching up to do and some stuff to look forward to in the prospect world. I mean, obviously, what we're really excited about is Jones-Cormier, but we're not that show. We can gush about that a little, but in general, that's not what we're here to do. We're here to look back at the recent fighters, the recent young fighters that have come up, and forward at the upcoming guys that we expect to see this weekend, and as well as covering a couple other topics that we've had kicking around. I think the big one I wanted to cover this time is something I've noticed recently in scouting, which is karate, and most particularly Russian karate. And it fed into a topic that you had talked about, which was, or that we I'd also suggested, and that we decided to conflate a little. Which was the idea of the strike, how important it is to have a striking base coming up, or at least more important than grappling. I mean, we all know that wrestling is the most important MMA base, fundamentally, globally. I mean, Sambo is a great one, but Sambo is very isolated.
And most of those guys, especially when we're talking about the North Caucasus context, they get into Sambo from wrestling anyway.
Yes.
So the difference is, you know, we might as well be talking about roughly the same thing.
But outside the wrestling aspect, if you're getting somebody who's not a wrestler, we want strikers.
Yes. Yeah.
And Russian karate is providing some interesting guys.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different things going. There are a couple of different things going on there that we could unpack. And the first of them is that, like every other sport in the Russian Federation in the former Soviet Union, karate there is run with the same kind of top down, organized, like school focused mindset that wrestling is, or that sambo is, or that judo is, or fencing, or whatever. You know, it's all run through an organized structure and organized regular competition. Like if you look at Chechen dictator Ramzan Kadyrov's Instagram page, there are regularly videos and photos of him at kids karate tournaments, and these are run on a massive scale with government assistance and through government offices. So
yeah.
Whenever you have that kind of structural support for something, you're going to end up getting really good athletes out of it. You know, they're going to be athletes that fit those skill sets and athletically fit those skill and rule sets very neatly.
Yeah, I mean, we've already seen the UFC sign one fighter who is still yet to debut, Adam Kaliev, out of it. And his brother, Hussein Kaliev, certainly appears to be on the rise into the UFC. I mean, that's a guy who's, I'm seriously just looking at my watch waiting for that announcement that he's signed with the UFC, considering that he's with K-Dojo, he's already got his visa, and he's fighting in the U.S.
Yeah. Only a matter of time there.
What?
Only a matter of time, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's seriously, we're talking a couple months, probably. But one of the guys that I, and this is a preview of our Featherweight Scouting Report, a minor one, But the reason this came up to me just recently was a guy, I don't know if you've looked at him at all, but Alexander Matmuratov.
Tom mentioned him to me, and I watched it, and I watched one of his fights, and I was fairly impressed by it.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a world karate champion, even on the outside the Russian circuit, and like outside the Kudo, which is what that's the Russian karate is. It's like, they call it Kudo, it's Daido Juku, offshoot kind of thing, the Japanese blending of full contact karate. But even on a more global circuit, he's a pretty big deal in the karate world. But in researching him, he trains at, I can't remember the name of the city he's from, but whatever that city is, it's like, you know, City Sport Club number 2. And it's absolutely that baseline thing. It's a state-sponsored combat sports academy.
Yep.
And it's produced a fantastic athlete with an amazing striking base.
Yeah, and like the thing I'm starting to realize more, the thing I'm starting to realize more and more, and this will segue neatly into the next point where I know you're going with this, is exactly what your striking base is matters a lot less than the fact that you have that experience to start with, because high level striking, regardless of the particular stylistic expression of it, is fundamentally about the same principles. It's about distance, it's about angles, and timing, really. And that's what it's about. And every single striking art, it doesn't matter whether it's boxing or Muay Thai or Dutch style kickboxing or karate or taekwondo or whatever, if you do it often enough, you will start to pick up those principles. Whether you're really trying to or not, you will start to get them.
Yeah, it's true. And it's one of those things that, like, unfortunately, and this is what really how I got here, was sort of like, I'd rather see, or not rather, but like, I'd more excited for a world-class striker entering MMA than I am a world-class grappler, quite frankly. And, you know, taking wrestling out of that equation, because as we've already said, wrestling is your baseline. But looking at, like, judo, jiu-jitsu, even like no-gi or catch, things like that, I'm much more excited for the world-class karateka or kickboxer. And the easiest way to even break this down is you look at Stephen Thompson, who is a decidedly mediocre kickboxer. I mean, we're not talking about any kind of world-class famous kickboxer, no matter how many times they call him a world champion. No. But he's already a really successful MMA fighter. Mm-hmm. Like, just has evolved really quickly to fit the sport really nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stephen Thompson is a good example of that. Like, his base could be whatever. And I know that there are a lot of people who do not like Stephen Thompson for a variety of reasons. And there are a lot of people who still, at this point, do not take him seriously, despite the fact that his one loss is to Matt Brown, who, as it turns out, is really fucking good.
Yeah.
And people still don't take him seriously on that account. But, like, you know, even if Stephen Thompson is a mediocre athlete to start with, you know, he's not super fast. He's not super strong. He's not going to be winning any kind of combine drill. You know,
no.
Like what Stephen Thompson is somebody who has a lifetime of experience as a striker, and the nuances of striking, and the reason why I get really excited when I see a prospect who can defend takedowns and strike with some nuance in his game, and the reason why you and Tom do as well, is because there is no substitute for time in learning striking. Like, you don't. There are almost no miracle stories of somebody who takes up striking and in a very short time is really, really good at it, in the same way as you get in grappling or even wrestling. You know, you hear that a little bit. Less so with wrestling, but you definitely hear it with grappling. Like Benny Dariush got his black belt in 4 years and went from having zero experience as an athlete, period, to being a almost world class black belt. 4 years it took him.
BJ Penn too,
and BJ Penn, pretty freakish athlete, but still, you know, it's grappling is about the time you put into it. Striking is about time, period. Like, it just takes forever to get you to understand timing and space and angles and things of that nature. There is no substitute for just doing it over and over again and spending the time and thinking about it really hard. Like, there's a reason why Anderson Silva wasn't like a scary next level kind of striker until he was 30 years old.
Yeah.
And that's after he started doing Taekwondo when he was like 11 or 12, you know? It took him 17 years of experience as a striker to become scary and next level. Conor McGregor started boxing when he was 12 or 13, you know? Like, it just takes forever to get those skills.
Yeah, I mean, if you remove heavyweight from boxing, just because heavyweight's always weird, even in boxing, you know, if you cut heavyweight out of the picture, you literally, like, I'm sure these people exist, but if I'm trying to think of a boxer that has just, like, the only guy I can think of that has materialized and just sort of become great quickly is that Argentinian middleweight who's recently cyclist.
You mean Sergio Martinez. Yeah, okay.
And that's about it. Like, you don't, you know, that kind of thing with him is super rare, and I can't think of hardly any world-class boxers that weren't, like, in the gym at six.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Paul Williams would be an example, who's now paralyzed in a pretty horrific car accident. But it's really rare to find high-level professional boxers who don't have an extensive amateur background. Right? Like, I think that's kind of what we're getting at here. It's like, you know, Reed for amateur background means you started boxing when you were 11, 12, 13, 14. You know, when you were a child, you started doing these things.
Yeah.
And you hear about that especially with Russians, guys who have 400 or something amateur fights. You know, Vasily Lomachenko and his famously long list, of amateur opponents. Gennady Golovkin, same deal, shitload of amateur fights. But yeah, I mean, all of that is code for they started doing that really, really early in life. Mm-hmm. And you know, maybe this starts to change as more kids start doing jiu-jitsu when they're 10 or 11 or 12. But at this point. I'm more inclined to think that there's something fundamentally different about the process of learning those skills.
Yeah, I do think it's. I mean, especially I think a big part of it is the difference between a sport in which contact, body to body contact, is instrumental, mm-hmm. and a sport in which it's not, in which distance is instrumental. I mean. And this isn't even, like, you know, wrestling, you hear it a little. You don't hear it to the world-class level. But you do hear about guys, at least at the collegiate level, who do really well, who came into it a bit late, like end of high school, things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that a sport that requires body-to-body contact gives a lot more leeway to pure athleticism and physicality. Yeah. Like, if you're just way stronger and faster than the guys you're going up against, you can cover up a lot of ground.
That's the common complaint that Russian or the former Soviet republics, the places where kids really do start to learn to wrestle for the most part when they're 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, their common complaint about U.S. wrestlers is that it's that we're playing a fundamentally different kind of game than they are. Like, I can't remember who it was. It may have been Denis Sargush who beat Jordan Burroughs this year at the Worlds. But it was either him or some other Russian dude who just at one point during a match smacked Jordan Burroughs upside the head because he's like, this is not wrestling. You know, Jordan Burroughs' entire game is predicated on his athleticism and his strength. Yeah. It's really technical too, but it's not technical in a way that the Russians understand. Like, and you know, you ask Coach Mike Reardon about the way the Russians wrestle, and it's like the Russians wrestle the way that they play chess. You know, with this incredible skill born of putting in tens of thousands of hours on the mat, which is not exactly the same way that Americans approach that sport.
Well, this is the funny thing. This is a wild generalization born of my own youth traveling. But it's one of those weird things that you encounter, it's most particularly in European cultures and in Russian culture, is that especially if you're talking to people in, you know, through English as their secondary language, what you'll hear a lot is you'll hear people tell you that you can't do something as a way of saying that you shouldn't do something. Like, if you're playing a game and you're, like, I remember I was playing cards with somebody and there were two of us and we're like, oh, I was like, oh, let's play poker. He's like, no, we can't play poker. There's only two people. Like, you can't play poker with two people. Yeah. And it's just like, no, we can. Like, we could do this. It's something we could do. But there's this divide of, like, that's not how you do it. Like, you just don't do that because that's not how it's done.
Yeah, Connor Rebush and I were talking about this on Heavy Hands a few weeks ago. We were talking about regional differences in style in combat sports, and he said this with regard to the kind of Eastern Bloc approach to boxing, but I think it also holds true for their approach to wrestling and other combat sports as well. But the belief there that there is fundamentally a right way and a wrong way to do things. Right.
Yeah.
And part of that has to do with, and a lot of that has to do with the way that those sports are structured there. They're primarily taught through large group classes and partner work, and you have the instructor walking around saying, yes, this is right, this is wrong. Whereas the American system is much more individually focused and always has been. This is especially true of boxing, but it's also true of other combat sports in the U.S. as well. That, you know, there's a lot of focus on making things work for you in the U.S. in a way that there is not necessarily in the Eastern Bloc.
Yeah. And to that point, I mean, I have heard it said, especially of Sambo and maybe of wrestling, that some of those systems have a lot more freedom, or they encourage a lot of freedom of expression. Mm-hmm. But I would say, like, it's a different idea of, it's like that idea, and this is something I put it to art, because it's an easy way for me to explain this, is the idea of the classic way that art is taught is that you learn how to do it properly so that you can break it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, you learn the right way to paint, you learn the right way to write, you learn the right way to sculpt or whatever. You learn all the functions and forms so that you can break them in ways that are individual to you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And now the modern way, especially in the U.S. of teaching art, is much more, let's do what works for you. You don't need to learn all the right ways as long as you learn what works for you. And that's something that, like, that's the kind of separation. It's like you can still have a very strict system that leads to a lot of freedom of expression, but you can also just have the freedom of expression. And they can both be equally as expressive in the end, but that doesn't mean that one doesn't have a lot more structure than the other.
Yeah, and I would say I certainly don't mean to imply that the Eastern Bloc system is just turning out little clones of each other, because that's not the case. But like to the extent that there are technically correct ways of executing particular movements, and then within that you can do you know there are infinite ways of chaining them together and creating a unique whole out of that. But in terms of the individual movements, there are technically correct and technically incorrect ways to do those things.
Yeah
But no, I think that's a really good way of looking at it. What you're saying makes a whole lot of sense.
So beyond that, so that gets, you know, brings us all back to, I guess we should now cut back to the last UFC event we had, which was Machida versus Dolloway, because I feel like we've covered this ground somewhat. And the karateka therein, Marcio Alexandre Jr., and a clear example of karate not working in MMA at all.
Yeah. I mean, I think a big part of the problem there is that he's just not an awesome athlete, and he doesn't train with a big camp. And like, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with his base skill set per se. So much as if you want to make karate work in MMA, you have to make everything else work too.
Yeah.
And in this case, just nothing else works. Like his base skill set is fun and it's fine, but like in the absence of those other things, it's just really difficult to make it work.
Well, and one of the big problems for him too coming up is that he fought almost nothing but cans prior to getting to The Ultimate Fighter. Mm-hmm. And he had a kind of skill and a kind of... He had something that really worked for him on Tough, which was an individual skill that nobody else was ready for. Mm-hmm. and that he could do, and he didn't have to cut a lot of weight. He wasn't a big middle, he was a very small middleweight. So, you know, he wasn't suffering from the weight cuts. He had an unusual skill that other guys weren't used to seeing. It helped him a lot on The Ultimate Fighter. And now on the other side, you see a game that's incredibly deficient from facing bad competition.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, but the way in which tough is a fundamentally different situation than an actual modern-day MMA fight. Like,
yeah.
They are fundamentally different things, and there are things that work to your favor on tough that don't work for you otherwise. And look at, like, Rose Namajunas is a perfect example of that.
Yep.
Unorthodox style, a lot of shit going on there that's really hard to deal with if you've only got a few days to worry about it, and you have to be cutting weight But give yourself 3 months to prep for it, and you can bring in training partners, and you can game plan around it, and you can really figure out not just the moves, but the underlying principles behind them, suddenly not nearly as threatening, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's, like, that's not to say that Marcio Alexandre is a terrible fighter or anything like that, but the kind of structure and context of modern MMA does not lend itself to the kind of success that he found on tough.
Yeah, and it'll take, you know, given another 3 years on the Brazilian regional circuit, who knows? He could certainly turn something around.
Yeah, I mean, so it's... What you mentioned in terms of having fought nothing but cans is really, really common on the Brazilian regional scene. We both know this. A lot of dudes who come up fighting nothing but guys who are 0-1, 1-3, 0-0, like guys making their debut. A guy who's the very opposite of that, this was really striking to me when I was scouting him before his fight, Renato Carneiro. Who made his debut on this card. That dude fought every regional featherweight in Brazil of note before he made it to the UFC, and he crushed them all.
Yeah. We're putting the polishing touches on our scouting report, but had he not been signed already, I got to think he would have been top five.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. And that's a division that, like, we're going to be doing, you know, we're going to be covering 30 guys. Tom's doing an extra that's going to be 10 fighters deep. I'm doing an extra that's going to be 10 fighters deep. Because there are so many guys with a ton of potential. But, you know, this is a guy who would have been probably in the top 10% of that, 15% of that group. And looks totally awesome. I mean... he beat the piss out of Tom Ninomaki, which, to say Tom Ninomaki hasn't been on a great run lately, but he still looked utterly dominant.
Yeah, I mean, and even more than how dominant he looked, it was the way that he was dominant and the particular skills that he showed in that dominance, you know? It's not like he came out and physically overpowered Ninomaki, though his physicality was certainly part of his win. You look at the things that he did. He was backstep punching with great technical skill. Backstep punching is one of the hardest skill sets to acquire, because it's not the same thing as taking a step back, planting your feet, and throwing. That's something different, and that's not nearly as hard to do. Backstep punching is when you are punching as you are stepping backwards. It's much harder to do. It's hard to get weight behind those shots in a proper technical fashion. It's hard to time them. It's hard to throw them without looking like a fucking idiot, to be real honest. Like, even backstep jabbing is hard. Like, from a technical perspective, but Moicano was doing that easily. I mean, he looked like a natural. He was a sharp kicker, and obviously, once it did turn into a grappling match, I mean, Ninomaki was out of luck real quick.
Yeah, now Moicano's a blue chip prospect, if ever there was one, and will very quickly, I think, and you know, he may be on the fast track to being in the top 10. In a division that, quite frankly, needs some new blood in the top 10. I mean, the fact that Clay Guida, Darren Elkins, and even, to a point, Jeremy Stephens are still top 10 featherweights, which is weird because this is a division that's, like, brimming with top talent at the bottom end. Like, you look at the bottom half of featherweight division, it's just like, Jesus Christ, there are so many guys that are really, really good fighters. You know, like, Sean Soriano is one of the least impressive featherweights in the UFC. That's how good their featherweight division is.
I'm looking forward to talking about Soriano, I guess, next week or the week after before he fights on the Boston card. Soriano is really good, you know?
Yeah.
That's the thing that's crazy about this is that he has gone 0-2 in the UFC, having fought Tatsuya Kawajiri on short notice, and then Chaz Skelly. Both of those guys are really good. And Soriano is on the verge of getting cut, but he's also good. That dude would have been competitive in an old school Bellator featherweight tournament, you know?
Oh, easily. And I mean that division is just so ridiculously deep, and Moicano looks like one of the best up and comers in it.
You know, you gotta feel for a dude like Clay Guida, because his time in that division is going to run out very shortly, and probably his time in the UFC as well. Just because there are so many dudes like that who are on their way up, I think Elkins is still going to get a little bit better and kind of hang around the top 15, top 20. But I think this is true of Jeremy Stevens too, a guy who's coming up on the 10-year anniversary of starting his professional career. Like, there is so much talent coming up that, like lightweight and like welterweight, you know, when you lose your fight with a top 10 guy, they give you a fight with the 15th or 20th best featherweight or lightweight or welterweight. You know, you're going to lose that fight if you've fallen off your peak.
Yeah. It's very true. I mean, you look at the guys populating the middle of that division, and you're still looking at guys like Maximo Blanco or Diego Brandão or Max Holloway. I mean, you know, you're looking at guys who are still really dangerous fighters, even if they're not always on point. Even Daniel Pineda who's the other guy? The Filipino guy. He's like a part-time fighter. He just lost to Thiago Tavares.
Oh, Jesus. Do you mean Robbie Peralta?
Yeah, Robbie Peralta.
Yeah.
You know, guys like that are the middle of that division. And, you know, you compare that to something like middleweight, where your middle is Andrew Craig
and Rafael
Natal and Trevor Smith. It's a drastically different middle of your division.
Yeah, and there's just, I mean, there's very little margin for error there. And if you are in the midst of a real career decline, you're going to end up out of the UFC before you've had a chance to right the ship.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that it sucks because that wasn't the case with featherweight when the UFC introduced the division. It was much thinner. There was more room for guys like Kenny Florian, who obviously a fine fighter. But like, you look at the Kenny Florian that made the drop and fought Jose Aldo coming up on 3.5 years ago now. That dude is probably not a top 10 featherweight relative to the guys who are populating the top 10 right now, which is crazy.
Yeah,
I mean, it's nuts, but I think that's probably the case.
Yeah.
But let's see what else we got on this card. We have a pair of prospects who have been talked about as high level guys for a very long time, who look to be finally putting things together in Marcos Rogério de Lima and Hakran Diaz.
Yeah, Hakran Diaz is he's a prospect in the way that who's the guy that fought Tim Means before this last fight? Hernani Perpetuo was a prospect. Mm-hmm. Like, his name has been out there for like 5 years. And the same way Tom Ninamaki was a prospect, where it was just like, this guy is obviously good enough, he's been out there forever, just give him the shot already. And then his UFC career so far has been totally lackluster, and finally it appears something has clicked over and is really working for him.
Yeah, I mean, and Diaz may just be one of those guys who it does take a while for to put everything together for whatever reason. I mean, and that seems to be true of a lot of the Nova União guys. Like, this was true of Hanan Barão too. Like, I think we forget nowadays, but it took Hanan Barão 5.5 years as a professional to get to the WEC, not even the UFC. Yeah. It took him 5.5 years, you know? And I think a lot of the Nova União guys, it really just does take a while to get all of their skill sets together. It takes them a long time. I think this may speak to some underlying weakness in the way that camp is structured and the way instruction happens there, but it really takes them a long time to get their striking in order. Jose Aldo is one of the very few exceptions to that, a guy who was like a plus striker from, you know, within a year of starting his MMA career, but he's just that freakish. But Hayden Burrell was not like an awesome striker until like 6 years into his pro career.
Hakan I will Diaz, say, I think I've seen a little bit of change in that lately with some of the guys I've been scouting. I'm seeing more guys that are 2 or 3 years in and look really slick.
Are you thinking of like Felipe Froes?
Felipe Froes, Mata, yeah. Will Galvao.
Yeah, I got a Mata. I like him. Nicholas Mata, in case you're watching and you don't know who he is a spark plug of a little Nova Uniao prospect. He's about he looks like a Brazilian Chad Mendes kind of. Just like a jacked up, short dude who's got big power. He's hellaciously fun to watch, but he has beaten nobody. He's beaten nobody who's even halfway.
Yeah, but that is and isn't important. It is and it isn't. It's important when I say it's important.
Okay, that's fair. But we don't want to get derailed talking about Nicholas.
Yeah, we don't want to get derailed talking about featherweight prospects because I got a whole lot of shit to do with that.
Yeah, we'll get derailed talking about featherweight prospects on a later episode.
Yes. So the other guy you mentioned in there was Hakan Diaz and
Marcos Rogério de Lima.
Marcos Rogério de Lima. De Lima really has honestly followed the typical prospect track where he was, you know, he accelerated really quickly early, plateaued sort of around the 3 year mark, and now that he's about 6 years into his career, all of a sudden everything's kind of clicking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think a lot of it with him has to do with his physical development too. I mean, he was like, you look back at his fight with Mike Kyle back in Strikeforce, and he just did not look like an adult. You know, like, yeah, not like he was even that young. I think he was 23 or 24 at the time, but he just did not look like a grown man in there with Mike Kyle. Like, and Kyle kind of tossed him around and beat him up from top position, and that was how that fight went. But now you look at him, and he looks like a grown dude. You know, he looks like he probably cuts 20, 25 pounds to get down to 205. He's physically strong. He always hit pretty hard, but now you see, like, there's real power in his hands. And you see, like, what a lot of scouts saw in him back in 2010, early 2011, you know?
And
I think same's true of Hakan Diaz, you know, like back when he was 23, 24 years old, he was very technically skilled, but now that he's in his late 20s, he really looks like a grown human, and he can make that work for him.
Yeah, I mean, Hakan Diaz still has the athleticism to compete with anyone in the top 10, mm-hmm, potentially excepting Jose Aldo, but like, he's a very, very good athlete. Athleticism is not the problem for Hakan Diaz. Mm-hmm. The problem has been application. It's really like
And cardio too. And he's always struggled to, like a lot of dudes at a lot of Brazilian camps, has really struggled to make weight. Like, there's going to be like a big conversation about the shitty ways that big Brazilian camps have been cutting weight for a long time. But like, the sooner that conversation happens, the better, because they have not done a great job of it. Like, you look at some dudes, you know, 1FC flyweight champion Adriano Moraes, who is 5'8" and not skinny and cuts to flyweight, and you're like, that is not a natural thing. That dude is not a flyweight.
Yeah. And
you wonder about what the long-term effects of those are going to be, and to a certain extent, things like Hayden Burrell slipping and falling and hitting his head, getting out of the bathtub, like, those things are certainties when those are your weight-cutting practices, as they seem to be for a lot of big camps there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it was Tim Means, too, that had, like, slipped in the sauna and fell when he was trying to cut to lightweight, and now he's at welterweight. Like, maybe, you know, guys who get injured while weight cutting maybe go up a division. Like, maybe that's not the worst idea, you know, that could be out there.
Yeah.
If you're really a great fighter, the division is marginally important.
Yeah. There are ways around that. But so who else do we want to talk about? Rashid Magomedov's awesomeness real fast.
Really fast, I think it should be said that Rashid Magomedov is no longer a prospect. This was his final time that he will be talked about on this show. From here on out, he's just an awesome dude that everybody should know about and watch. And if you don't know about Rashid Magomedov at this point, I got nothing to tell you. I got no help for you.
Yeah, if you're not impressed by the way that he absolutely took apart Elias Silverio, who is a pretty solid striker and a pretty good fighter all around, mm-hmm. if you're not impressed by that, you need to reevaluate your priorities. Because, like, this is... Watching Magomedov's first three UFC fights has been a fascinating look inside. Like, you take a guy who's a good striker to start off with, and this speaks to what we were talking about earlier in terms of striking being being the second most important skill set to have as a prospect after wrestling. Like, so Magomedov was a good striker to start with. He gets to the UFC, and you can see flashes of the kind of counter-striking game that he really likes in his first UFC fight against Tony Martin. Uh-huh. He really plays around with that, but can't fully get it into gear in his second UFC fight against Rodrigo Dam. Now, in his third fight, he's had a full year of UFC training with UFC caliber fighters at Team Takedown and ATT, in addition to all the work that he's done back in Dagestan and in Moscow. And you can really see, oh, this is step by step how a guy goes from being a really good striker by prospect standards and a good UFC level striker to an elite MMA striker. Like, you can see it happen piece by piece. You can see his movements getting smaller and more efficient. You can see the increased power in his shots. Like, this dude is ready to challenge guys in the top 15.
Yeah, no question. And the great thing is, too, that, like, on that perfect arcing track, he's also, like, just 30. He's just hit the six-year mark in his career. Like, mm-hmm. everything is clicking for him to be right in his prime, right now, fighting at his best. Mm-hmm. And it's hard not to just see more good things happening going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when Gleison Tibau struggles to take you down and hold you down, you know you've got excellent takedown defense and you're ready to fight anybody in that division. Like, that is a dude who, I mean, just get excited about him. Can't give enough superlatives.
Yeah, so that's our send-off to Rashid Magomedov, no longer a prospect, no longer a part of our show, but a fantastic fighter having arrived. On the other flip side of that, we got a couple of guys who lost, a trio of losers to talk about. First and foremost, Mike Rhodes.
Let's get him out of the way right now. There are two parties that we need to talk about right here real quick. The first is his management for being willing to put him in fights with the dudes that they have over the course of his career, because it's not just the three dudes that he lost to in the UFC. It's also when they put him in a fight with Brandon Thatch on short notice in RFA. That should have been the first sign that there was something really wrong with how they were looking at his career. Then you have the short notice matchup with George Sullivan. That's fine. That's probably a fight that had Rhodes not cut 35 pounds in 10 days to get down for that, he probably would have won that fight. I mean,
it was a split. I mean, it was a razor close fight against a really tough fighter. That's a fine fight. Like,
yeah, and that's not like a bad learning experience for a dude making his UFC debut. The problem is when you take him from a fight with George Sullivan, you put him in there with Robert Whittaker, who is a very similar fighter in terms of skill sets and the things that he does well, just 2 or 3 years more advanced.
Yeah.
So you put him in there. In like you've got to fly 6,000 miles to get there to make for that fight. You're coming off a loss. You badly need time in the gym, and you need to rebuild a little bit and work on things. So you put him in there. Then you put him in there. Then he loses that fight. It was competitive, but
yeah.
Whittaker clearly won. It was a decision. Then for the piece de resistance, you put him in there in Brazil with Eric Silva, coming off two losses, knowing that he's probably going to get cut when he loses. Like, you have got to be fucking kidding me. Like from Joe Silva's perspective, like, it's not his job. It is his job, and it is not his job to worry about these things.
Yeah.
Like, if you think that this is a talented young dude who could be something, then you don't put him in those matchups. So either Joe Silva gave up on him, or he just badly needed dudes to take these fights. And I think all of those perspectives are totally fucked up here, because Rhodes is a talented dude. I mean, I sincerely hope that he gets his career back on track in the regionals, and I think he will. I think he's talented enough to do that. But, you know, like, whatever his management was thinking, whatever the UFC was thinking, like, this is just a case in how not to build a prospect. Like, just awful, shitty work from everybody involved.
Yeah, it's true, and I hope he can go and just spend 2 or 3 years just crushing dudes on the regional scene. Build up a nice long undefeated streak and come back into the UFC in his late 20s, really fully developed fighter. Because if he comes back quickly, if he wins a fight or two and then comes right back around, that may not be enough time to get his confidence back on track. I mean, you get another loss or two and suddenly you're on the outside again. You've been in the UFC twice early in your career, and you could be heading into that territory of the guy who's always waiting for the call-up and never quite achieving anything on the big show.
Yeah, I mean, then you're in Efrain Escudero territory, basically.
Yeah.
Like, that's actually the perfect guy to describe that. Like, you're just, I think it's interesting that you mentioned confidence, because this was something, when I went down to Kings and I was talking to Rafael Cordero, Cordero thinks that confidence is the single biggest thing that matters in a fight. And, you know, I think that they're, like, I understand where he's going with that. I think he's distilling things down quite a bit. But really, as a statement of purpose, if you believe in yourself and you're not so much worried about what the other guy is going to do, but what you're going to do, you let your coach worry about what the other guy is going to do, and you let him train you to deal with those things. But you put all that stuff out of your head, like, when you get your confidence shook as a fighter, like, that is the worst thing that can possibly happen to you. Because suddenly all of those doubts come into play, and it slows you down. You start thinking when you should just be reacting and slipping into that kind of no mind state that you have to be in to win fights. Like, when you get to that point, like, you may never come back from that. Like, if you understand what that feels like, you may never get back.
Yeah, it's a significant. I mean, like, when I'm thinking about, you know, when you're scouting a guy, basically the first two things I'm ever looking for are athleticism and aggression. Mm-hmm. And the aggression is, like, I mean, there is aggression born of a lack of confidence. Certainly, you can see aggression born of fear, born of the fear that if you don't get this guy out of there quick, you're gonna lose. But if you're looking for patient, consistent aggression, that is confidence. It's the ability to stay in front of your opponent and consistently try to hurt them and not being worried that the next thing that's going to happen to you is that you're going to lose.
Yeah. That's the perfect fighter to talk about that kind of confidence is Conor McGregor. Because that was the first thing that jumps out at you on film before he ever debuted in the UFC. This is not just speaking with hindsight. This is not speaking with the benefit of hindsight. This was, like, at the time, because I remember you and I were talking about him before his UFC debut. We had both watched some mm-hmm. of his fights and we were chatting about him. And, like, that's the thing that jumps out at you. It's that he's not afraid of what his opponent's going to do. He's got the mindset, my opponent needs to be worried about what the fuck I'm going to do to him. In addition to the athleticism, that's the first thing that jumps out at you. And it was what always jumped out at you about old Shute box fighters. It's something that we'll talk about here in a minute when we start talking about prospects on UFC 182 with Cody Garbrandt, because I think he exemplifies that as well.
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of the prototype of lost confidence, changed fighter, you don't have to look any further than Wanderlei Silva.
Yeah.
There's a guy who fought with all the confidence in the world for years, and was just, even when he lost, he was confident. Even after he got just destroyed by Vitor Belfort, he was not a less confident fighter.
No.
And then late in his career, you know, he started getting knocked out. I think it was really the Krokop knockout was the start for a lot of people, but may have been the Rampage knockout that happened not long afterward. And suddenly, he was always rushing to get the finish. It was no longer, you know, I am the unbeatable machine that will stalk you and break you. It's, I better hit you really hard, really quickly, because I can't take getting hit.
And Wanderlei said as much after he got knocked out by Chris Leben. He's like, I wanted to get him out of there so bad that I just kind of ran forward. Mm-hmm. And you can see, I don't think it's a coincidence that when he got that the next fight was when he really started working a lot with Cordero again. That was when he fought Kung Lee. Mm-hmm. And you could see he really had his mojo back. He was patiently stalking from the outside, and he would pick his moments, and he would come in. Like, yeah, I think there's absolutely something to that. I had never quite thought about it in those terms before, but I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot to that.
So the other losing fighters we need to talk about, now that we've thoroughly diverted ourselves once again. Antonio Carlos Jr. and Antonio Dos Santos Jr. Two Antonios, two Juniors, two very different losing performances.
Yeah, Antonio Carlos Jr. just gave us a wonderful clinic in how to not fight a chain wrestler. You know, like, because Cummins is not a guy, it's not enough to just say, well, this guy isn't good against wrestlers, or, you know, this guy has crappy takedown defense. That is a really reductive way of looking at situations like this. You need different strategies to fight different kinds of wrestlers. And Pat Cummins, at heart, is a guy who really excels at chain wrestling once he gets on your hips. You may stuff his first attempt, you may stuff his second attempt, but that third one, he's gonna get you down, you know?
Yeah.
And your priority when you fight a guy like that, is that you have to keep him off your hips in the first place. It's not enough. You can't initiate an exchange, shoot on him. He stuffs you. Then you think that you're going to outwork him in steps 4, 5, 6, 7 of that exchange, because it's not going to happen. Like, the perfect example of how to fight a guy who wrestles like that is Anthony Johnson versus Phil Davis.
Yeah.
Rumble did everything humanly possible to keep Davis away from him, to keep him either in the pocket or at range. Because as Glover Teixeira learned, once you let Davis onto your hips, he's a monster. He may not get you down the first time, he may not get you down the second time, he may not get you down the third time, but eventually if you let him stay there, he will get you down.
Yeah, and the thing is that, I mean, and this is the weird thing. This is the weird thing to me, is now Carlos Jr. is headed to middleweight. He said, the moment that fight was over, he said, I'm going to middleweight. And, watching him in that fight, he wasn't athletically out of his class. He wasn't out-muscled. The early shots when Cummins would get in on him, he actually was able to keep his feet, keep his base, keep Cummins from taking him down. He had the strength and the athletic ability to fight Patrick Cummins.
Mm-hmm.
He just fought the most boneheadedly, mind-numbingly stupid strategy, and that's not something that's going to be solved just by going down a weight class.
No, I mean, I think cutting down a weight class at that point is taking the path of least resistance, in that it allows you to not think about the other ways that you fucked up in that fight.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure what he's thinking about when he's saying, I'm going down to middleweight, is what it felt like when Cummins was on top,
mm-hmm.
when the weight that a guy who's been wrestling since he was 12 or 13 years old can put on you, you know? Like, and that's an incredibly intimidating feeling to have that guy on top and feel the strength in the base and just the unbelievable core strength and balance that those guys have. Like, it's easy to think about that and for your conclusion to be, well, that dude was just way stronger than me. But that's not what it was. It was the fact that Carlos Jr. allowed himself to get put in those situations in the first place. You have to entirely avoid to the greatest extent humanly possible, avoid the tactical realm where that guy putting you on your back is a possibility, you know? Like,
yeah.
There's no question about who the better range striker in that fight was. It was Antonio Carlos Jr. The only way for Cummins to win that fight was on the inside in the wrestling exchanges and from top position. I mean, it was a failure of game planning and training as much as anything else.
Pretty much, and it's unfortunate because this has become the story of light heavyweight, is that it's so easy, and it's one of those things that I try to explain to people, and I don't know if it becomes clear until you see something like this, is that it's not hard, and it's not that hard to cut to 185 if you're a fighting weight that's not like that's right for 205. Like it's almost like 205 doesn't really exist as its own weight class, because if you're like 220 pounds, you can cut to 185.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's become like the new thing. And so every time a guy loses there, he's just like, oh, I'll just go down to middleweight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as opposed to addressing the actual real problems there. And you know, I think where that really started was with Chris Weidman, because I think people heard. Like I think the first time that I can ever really remember hearing about how big middleweights really were and what they walked around at was when Chris Weidman was cutting down for the Damian Maia fight, when they were saying, you know, he cut 32 pounds, he was walking around at 217, He cut from 217 to 185 in like 12 or 14 days or whatever it was that he had for that fight. And like I think that was a wake up call to a lot of dudes who were fighting at light heavyweight that like, oh man, he can do that in 12 or 14 days. I can do that if I have a whole fight camp. And suddenly, like, the bottom just fell out of light heavyweight. All the depth was gone. All those guys cut to 185.
Now, did you see that Sean Strickland is headed to welterweight?
Actually, that makes a weird kind of sense to me.
Does it? I thought he was big for middleweight. Like, he did not seem at any kind of size or strength advantage against Luke Barnett. Yeah. And Barnett is huge.
I mean, I didn't say I thought it was a good idea. It makes a certain kind of sense to me that he would have fought Luke Barnett and thought, I need to move down to 170.
Like, yeah.
I think it's a shitty move. Yeah. Because he's a young dude. He's only 22 or 23. Mm-hmm. And he's going to get a lot bigger. He's going to get a lot bigger in the next few years if he's on any sort of competent strength and conditioning program. I mean, if he's walking around at 205 pounds right now, which seems pretty reasonable. He's not like a huge middleweight. He's a good size middleweight. But in 3 years, if he's doing all of his diet and strength and conditioning and everything right, he's going to be a 215 or 220 pound guy trying to cut down, you know? Yeah. Like, I think that's the thing a lot of young guys don't realize. Maybe they're fighting at, let's say, middleweight on the regional scene. They get to the UFC, they have one or two fights at middleweight, and then they cut down. Like Court McGee, right?
Yeah.
Well, Court McGee is a good example of this, where you have a couple of fights at that weight, and then you fight somebody who makes you realize that, oh, shit, the upper end of this weight class is just stocked with huge dudes. You drop down, but then you give it a few more years, and you realize, like, damn, this sucks. This is really hard. I'm never eating anything. I'm more prone to injury because I'm not eating anything. And then, you know, you think, like, maybe it'd be a good idea to move back up. Like Robert Whittaker fought a lot at middleweight on the regional scene when he was a kid. Comes to the UFC, he's fighting at 170, and now he realizes, like, Jesus, this feels a lot better to be doing this. I think a lot of guys are going to come to those conclusions.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting progression to see how the whole weight thing. I think there's a bit of a reorganization of ideology there, as it gets to the point that it's so drastic that you're really going to start seeing guys notably affect their performances trying to make weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Daniel Sarafian, speaking of another guy who fought on this card, when he tried to cut down the welterweight, it was just a disaster of epic proportions.
And you can even see him at middleweight, and yeah, he's not tall, but the dude is beefy as fuck. Like, his torso is twice as wide as everybody else's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just a physiological thing that it means you don't fight at the right weight for your height. You know, you fight up.
And the fact that somebody like Mike Dolce, I will use his name explicitly, the fact that Mike Dolce looks at Daniel Sarafian and sees a welterweight does not mean that that's the right thing for him, you know? No. The fact that you can get somebody down to that weight does not necessarily mean that you should.
Yeah, no question. So that brings us to the last loser, and one that really performed pretty well, all things considered. Mm-hmm. Antonio Dos Santos Jr., fought like a short-notice fighter, basically just said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to be as aggressive as possible. If it works, it works. And then had a ridiculous finger injury and just popped that fucker in and said, let's go, and wasn't able to. But I love him for it.
Yeah, it's kind of awesome, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of awesome. I mean, you know, is it weird and crazy and should the fight have been stopped? Yeah. Yeah, I don't think anybody reasonable disagrees on those things. You don't just get to call time in the middle of a fight and pop your finger back in. That's never going to be an acceptable thing under the rules. But at the same time, it's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of okay with that.
He looks like a good fighter, though. I mean, he, you know, Sarafian didn't get any kind of his takedown game going at all. So at that point, it was purely a test of chin and power, and I don't even know that I would trust Sarafian there.
No,
fight continued.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty surprised by how good Dos Santos looked. His nickname is Junior Alpha. So if you're looking for, if you're interested in him and you want to try and find tape of his fights, you got to search that on the YouTubes as opposed to his actual name. He looked good. He looked like he'd made real improvements from his last outing in the Brazilian regionals. Good combinations, big power, really good kind of power punching mechanics. I was surprised at at how clean his weight transfer was. It wasn't just like he was swinging. He really had good mechanics.
Yeah. And he does a great job in scrambles, too, which is, like, a big credit to him, is that he's not a bad wrestler at all. He's actually a pretty good one for the Brazilian regional scene, and he's a very adept scrambler. So he's not, Serafian tried to take him down in one instant, and he just slid straight out the back and was back on his feet in half a second. And he's a fighter. He's a middleweight that actually has some real promise in a division without a lot of promising fighters.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Yeah, I mean, he was definitely the, from a prospect perspective, he was definitely the pleasant surprise of the night, because there were expectations around, like, Renato Moicano. There were expectations around Antonio Carlos Jr. Nobody expected anything from Antonio Dos Santos, and he comes out and looks pretty good. And so, you know, I'm interested to see what he does in his next outing.
Yeah. The big thing I'll be looking for is definitely, like, cleaning up his defense, and I think that's a function of his camp. I think coming in on short notice, it's really just, you go out to live by the sword, but die by the sword. And you see that a lot with short notice guys who are just like, shit, I'll just try and see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not necessarily the worst way to go about it. If you're a dude who's coming out of a relatively small camp and nobody knows who you are anyway, fuck it. Try and make a name, you know?
Yep.
Get people excited about you.
So lastly, and another disappointment, this brings us to another quick topic we wanted to cover, although we're running really low on time, but whatever, we got time. A little bit. Is Ulka Sasaki and Japanese fundamental failure.
Yeah, and this is actually a neat segue to talking about UFC 182 as well. Not that there are many prospects on that card. It's pretty stacked with dudes with some name value. This comes up when we're talking about Kyoji Horiguchi as well. Like, it is a real fundamental question as to whether the Japanese MMA scene can produce prospects who can compete on the world stage. It doesn't make sense that that would be a problem given the number of people who are involved in the Japanese MMA scene. You would think that by accident, just purely by accident, of having that many different competitors and that many different organizations with that many opportunities to fight, with that kind of tradition, of combat sports excellence, you have good scholastic wrestling programs, you have good Olympic programs in judo and wrestling, you have a lot of really good boxers, you have karate, you have so many different combat sports with high rates of youth participation and so many different opportunities for them to show their skills in relatively well-run regional organizations. It does not make sense that Japan would be producing so few high-level prospects. Like, it is a mind-boggling kind of thing. And so you look at Yuta Sasaki getting just dominated by Leandro Issa. Absolutely dominated by him. You look at Michinori Tanaka losing a very close, but still losing, a split decision to Kyung Ho Kang. You look at Mizuki Inoue a couple of months ago losing in Invicta. And these are the bright and rising stars of the Japanese MMA scene, and they are falling when they get to the big show. I don't think that's going to happen with Horiguchi. With Horiguchi against Luis Gaudino, he's like an 8-1 favorite, and he should be an 8-1 favorite. But you know, you got to wonder about the long term here, like what's happening. Because
if Kyoji Horiguchi fought Ali Bagatinov his next fight, mm-hmm. how sure would you be that Horiguchi wins? You know.
I mean, I would have Horiguchi as somewhere between -150 and -200 in that fight, but I would not at all be surprised if Bagatinov beat him. Like, yeah. I would have him as a favorite, but I wouldn't be surprised if Bagatinov won.
And I think that the big problem that we keep seeing over and over again is this fundamental lack of complete MMA gyms in general. That tends to be the biggest problem, especially with guys like Inoue, and it appears with Tanaka and Sasaki, is that there is no connection between any of the things that they do well.
Yeah.
They do them well, and then it's, you know, like somebody has to pull a lever, and that's like the wrestling lever or the striking lever or the grappling lever. And when that lever doesn't get pulled, you get Sasaki versus Leandro Issa. Issa's an okay fighter. He's been around for a long time. He's finally putting together some success. But he's a guy who struggled to beat Jumbeke Tuarshan.
Yeah. That's the part that's so hard to wrap your head around. And I remember When I did my prospect list this time a little over a year ago, and I had Michinori Tanaka on mine, and in my write-up of him, I said something to the effect of, you know, he's spent time at Alpha Male in the U.S., and that's really good. I think there are real questions about the gym that he trains out of. And I think it was Bloody Elbow's Anton Tabuena in the comments who said, well, but, you know, his gym is a really good one. It's one of the better gyms in Japan. And I said, exactly, it's one of the better gyms in Japan. You know, that's like, that compared to what the kind of instruction that he could get at a place, even go to Singapore and go to Evolve. You know,
yeah.
Go to the U.S., go to Europe, anywhere. Like the way that MMA is being taught in those places is 10 to 15 years ahead of where it's at in Japan. It just is. I mean, and you know, there are probably some people who would get mad when you say that explicitly, but it's true. And I can't remember where I heard it. I can't remember who was talking about it. I think it may have been Jack Encarnacion of Sure Dog was talking about Kyoji Horiguchi and talking about his camp and how old school Crazy B is.
Mm-hmm.
It's run by Norifumi Yamamoto, Kid Yamamoto. We all know and love him, but just how old school it is in terms of the training practices there.
And
old school is not a compliment.
No, I mean, like, if you watched video on Kichi Kunimoto and all those, and, who is the other fighter that, Sexyama, they did, like, a highlight video of those two for a recent UFC event, the big Japanese one with Hunt and Nelson,
mm-hmm.
and they showed, like, them training, and, you know, it's just a bunch of dudes in a room,
mm-hmm.
like, and that's not great. Or better yet, like a better example would be what's the woman that in the bantamweight division of the UFC?
Rin Nakai.
Rin Nakai. Like if you watch her training video, you know, and not the sexy ones where she's mostly naked. There are plenty of those too.
Or covered in spinning needles, alternatively.
But. Like, she's a very good judoka. There's no question about that. But she's, you know, she talks about how she trains. She's like, oh, I go to my boxing teacher, and I worked on my boxing. I go to my judo class, where I've been training since I was, like, 5, and I do my judo. And then I go and do, like, my strength and conditioning program. And I do some grappling.
And that's just so fundamentally counter to the way that MMA is being practiced in the real hotbeds of innovation. And I think that's actually the perfect segue to move to talking about the other big prospect on the UFC 182 card, and that's Cody Garbrandt. And Cody Garbrandt is the exact opposite in that he is the prototypical next generation mixed martial artist. He wrestled in high school, was an accomplished high school wrestler, was an accomplished amateur boxer starting in high school, and immediately after getting out of that, started doing MMA, and he's trained with Lance Palmer, who's from the same part of Ohio that he is, a World Series of Fighting featherweight champion, four-time All-American at Ohio State. He's trained with the guys at Henzo Gracie Pittsburgh, which has a whole bunch of really solid up-and-coming fighters at various weights. But then he's put in most of his time at Team Alpha Male, training with the crew there. And those are all places. Even a relatively small gym by U.S. standards in Henzo Gracie Pittsburgh is run much more closely along the lines of a top-flight MMA gym than the best gyms in Japan are.
Yeah. No, Garbrandt looks to be stepping into the UFC with a fully formed MMA game. All three dimensions, everything clicks, everything works. I mean, you even, like, I've been talking about this in relation to the guy he's fighting, Marcus Brimage. Cody Garbrandt and Marcus Brimage are basically at the exact same place in their career development, but Marcus Brimage has been fighting since 2007.
Yep. Yeah, and Cody, and like you look at Garbrandt's game, and this is what the bluest of blue chip prospects look like as we enter 2015. You know, his game is so hyper advanced for where he's at. You can really see. You know what an economist might call the network effects of being at big camps. You know, you can see that he has benefited from the kind of training that he's gotten. Like, he's obviously incredibly talented from naturally talented. I mean, he's got incredible power in his right hand. He throws one of the hardest right hands I think I've seen on a bantamweight ever throw. But yeah, I mean, just a hard kicker, very strong, excellent athlete, really fast. I mean, all of that, sure. But that's not separable from him as a product of these fundamentally different training regimens. You know, Cody Garbrandt has been in a strength and conditioning program since he was 14 or 15 years old. You know.
Oh yeah, at the very least. And I mean, you look too at, and this is the big thing to me. And this is one of the things that, if you're really looking for fighters, and who are really taking that next step, and who are really, you know, learning all the right things and who are training right. This is more training right than anything else. Is it's all about how they fill the space between stages. Mm-hmm. Now it's, what do you do while you're falling down? What do you do while you're getting up? What do you do while you're looking for that takedown, while you're pressed against the cage, while you're defending the takedown? And if the answer is largely nothing, that's something that you are fundamentally missing in terms of your MMA training. Even if you're becoming a very good boxer, becoming a very good wrestler, becoming a very good grappler, mm-hmm. if you can't fill the space in between what you know, like what your set moves are, you know, and obviously these are set things as well. This isn't like something where you just improvise. But if you're not filling that in-between space, that's where you're missing out on the MMA metagame.
Yeah, you really are, and when you look at Cody Garbrandt, you see that those spaces are chock full of offense. He's creating offense in every one of those interstitial spaces. You know, he'll put you on your back purely for the purpose of hitting you with knees and punches as you try and stand back up. As he's standing back up, he's looking to defend himself from the shots that get thrown there. He's looking to defend against submissions in transition, and he's looking to lock up submissions in transition. And that is the kind of stuff that you can only get at these really big, well-regarded gyms. I mean, there are individual coaches elsewhere who can teach it, but that whole package, you're only going to get that at these big places in the U.S. To a lesser extent, Brazil and Europe. Russia is kind of a little different, but yeah.
Russia's always going to be different. That's its own crazy thing, and it's insular. You can't tell somebody to, like, go to Russia and train, you know?
Yeah, that's just not at all how it works.
But so other than that, this is not a card replete, as we say, with prospects. I mean, this is a tough fight for him, but he's also at the stage 6 years into his career, getting into his mid-20s, that, you know, this is his time to turn the corner if he's going to do it.
Yeah.
This is his first big opportunity to turn the corner and become a top star. So
yeah, and I, to be honest, if we've got to pick winners there, I'm picking Jury. He's got nothing but ice water in his veins, and like that's what you, more than any individual skill set, that's what you need to beat Donald Cerrone.
And he's got the confidence in what he's doing, and Cerrone is, for as good a fighter as he is, there are strict limitations as to how he works.
Yes.
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the game plan for beating Cerrone is well established. It's a matter of execution. And you know, Eddie Alvarez had a pretty good idea of what the game plan was. The Black Zillions had a pretty good idea of what the game plan was, but they missed some fundamental things, and that's what got Eddie beat. You know.
So, and I got to talk about this briefly because, Nilsson's already lost. He's a good prospect. Omari Akhmadov is really raw and whatever. They've lost it. But, and Cannonier is just totally raw. I mean, he could beat Sean Jordan. It's not going to be meaningful, whatever he does.
Sean Jordan is a lower middle tier UFC heavyweight and is so hittable in any given fight that, like, even if Cannonier does put his right hand on his chin, like, it doesn't really tell us much.
Yeah, I mean, it's a coin flip fight because it's almost certainly going to be a sloppy brawl where the first guy to land a really big shot wins it, and Jordan's barely more likely to land the first shot. But the guy I want to talk about is Felder, because you're picking Felder to win, right?
Yeah, I am picking Felder.
So he's a great athlete. He's a shockingly strong athlete. That was what shocked me in his fight with Jason Sago. But otherwise, good enough fighter to beat Castillo. What's going on? I'm not sure on that.
This comes back to something that we were just talking about in terms of filling up the spaces in between where things are happening. And more than anything physical about Felder, what really stands out to me is that he is always looking to do damage to you. And so he's kind of a next generation sprawl and brawler. He reminds me a lot of Darren Cruikshank in the broad outlines of his game. But really what stands out to me is the fact that Felder, it's not just that he can defend takedowns. He can defend takedowns very well. He's a very, very good defensive wrestler. It's not just that he defends takedowns. It's that he's going to elbow the shit out of you while you do it. If you shoot on him out in the middle of the cage and he sprawls and grabs a front headlock, he's going to hit you from the front headlock, you know? And that to me speaks to the next evolution of the metagame of MMA. It's not just that you defend those takedowns, it's that you make your opponent pay for it while he does it. So like Yoel Romero will do that. If a guy shoots on him and he sprawls, Yoel Romero is going to punch the shit out of you from that position as long as you're content to stay there. And that's what I like about Felder's game more than thinking about kind of the broad sprawl and brawler versus wrestle boxer matchup. It's those interstitial spaces.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting. I mean, let me put it this way: I don't doubt that Felder could win it. I'm not sure I see it for him, just because, I mean, even with Sago, who was much less athletic than Felder, he struggled at times. And Castillo is certainly a much more practiced and more consistent fighter and better athlete. But I mean, Felder is a guy that. I mean, I think a lot like, who was it that we were talking about? Sullivan. A lot like Sullivan, Felder is one of those guys that is going to be like, he's a kind of a fun, tough bastard that's going to be fun to watch no matter what fight he's in.
Yeah, I mean, and I realize that I'm picking the underdog there, and I'm not trying to make the argument that Felder should be the favorite, or that there's like a ton of value in, or that there's a ton of value in him. I think that Felder's game is really interesting in particular ways, and that's why I stuck with that pick. I just think that he does really interesting things in kind of a metagame context, and like I'm fine taking a pick flyer on him, even if I think it's closer to a 50-50 fight than the betting odds indicate. I would not at all be surprised if Castillo came out and just ground the shit out of him, or even kind of knocked him out. I don't think I would be super surprised at that. But I'm intrigued by Felder's game. I put it that way.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it surprised me a little because I like watching Felder fight, but I don't look at him and be like, there's the next, you know, like. He's fun, but there's still a lot of work to be done in getting him beyond fun.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm not trying to make any claims about Paul Felder, 2016 UFC lightweight champion. No, I think that he does interesting things, and that's more or less what it boils down to. Like I want to see as a matter of course, I want to see more fighters doing the kinds of things that he does. That's kind of what it boils down to.
All right, I think that covers all the bases we really wanted to cover for today. So if you enjoyed watching this, give it a like over on YouTube. We're starting this on a new YouTube channel, so I will post a link to it in the post that goes up on Bloody Elbow. And you can follow me at DZaneSimon on Twitter, Patrick at Patrick_Wyman on Twitter. You can find him on SureDog.com. You can find me on BloodyElbow.com. Keep your eye out for the first half of the Featherweight Scouting Report coming up soon, I believe next week, if not this weekend. And we'll see you soon. Thanks.